I want you to try a mental exercise with me. Just close your eyes and picture the very beginning of everything.
Like that moment right before the universe even existed?
Exactly. What do you see?
I mean, I think most people probably default to a cinematic black screen, just complete silence, and then bam, a massive flash of light.
Right, the Big Bang. Or if you're coming from a Judeo-Christian background, the let there be light moment, it's this idea of a creation out of absolutely nothing.
Ex nihilo.
Right, ex nihilo. One minute there is zero, and the next minute there's a whole cosmos. It's clean, it's instant.
And it's really deeply ingrained in how we think about reality today.
It is. We tend to view creation as, well, almost like a magic trick. The rabbit wasn't in the hat, and now it is.
But what if that assumption is entirely wrong?
Or at least, what if it completely misses how the ancient world viewed the universe?
Specifically Plato, because how he viewed the job description of God is totally different.
Fundamentally different, yes. And that's what we are unpacking today. We're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes on Plato's theology and cosmology.
It's a brilliant lecture. He completely breaks down how Plato transitioned from his early abstract ideas to a grand cosmic theory.
And our mission here is to understand how Plato connects that abstract world of perfect ideas to the very messy physical world you and I actually live in.
And crucially, how he tries to solve the ultimate puzzle.
The problem of evil.
Exactly. Why a supposedly good universe has so many bad things in it.
I have to say, going through the source material really messed with my head because Plato doesn't give us a magician pulling a universe out of a hat.
Not at all.
He gives us something closer to, and this is how I picture it, a stressed out architect trying to build a skyscraper out of jello.
That is a very vivid image.
It's accurate though, right?
You're actually not far off. To understand why, we have to start with how Plato divides up reality. Dr. Holmes outlines three distinct realms in the lecture.
Right, and I think most of you listening are probably familiar with the first two, at least vaguely. You've got the realm of being and the realm of becoming.
Classic Platonism right there. The realm of being is the level of reality that never changes. It's eternal.
It's perfect.
Yes, this is where the forms live.
The forms, we've touched on this in other discussions, but it's the idea that there is a perfect non-physical concept of, say, justice or beauty.
Or even something mundane like a chair.
Right, the perfect form of a chair. And every physical chair we see in our world is just a flawed shadow of that perfect blueprint.
Precisely. The form is the ultimate blueprint. Then you have the second realm, which is becoming.
That's the physical world we're sitting in right now.
It is. And it's called becoming because nothing here ever truly is. Everything is constantly in flux.
A flower is blooming or it's wilting.
You are aging every single second. Nothing stands still in the realm of becoming.
Like Heraclitus said, you can't step in the same river twice.
Exactly. The physical world is unstable by nature. But then Holmes introduces the third realm, and this is where things get really tricky.
The realm of non-being.
Non-being.
Now, my immediate instinct is to say that's just empty space, you know, a vacuum, a gap between atoms.
And that would be the modern scientific intuition. But Plato means something much more unsettling. For him, non-being isn't just empty space.
What is it then?
Holmes puts it beautifully. He says it is the total privation of thought.
Privation of thought. That sounds like my brain before my morning coffee.
It's not a bad analogy, actually. Think of it as the intelligible versus the unintelligible. The forms, the realm of being, are perfectly understandable.
Because they make logical sense. 2 + 2 = 4.
Exactly. But non-being is the total opposite. It is completely chaotic, it's irrational, it's essentially nothing in particular.
So it's not a void, it's a mess.
It's the raw material of the universe before it had any structure whatsoever. Holmes calls it primal matter.
Plato sometimes calls it the receptacle, right?
He does, but Holmes uses a term from the lecture that I know you absolutely loved.
The primal glop.
The primal glop.
I love that so much because it sounds so unphilosophical, but it actually explains the concept perfectly.
It really does.
Because in the Judeo-Christian story, God speaks and matter just appears, boom. But Plato is saying, no, the glop was always there.
And that is the critical distinction here. For Plato, matter is eternal. It coexists with God.
It was never created.
Right. But in its natural state, it's just this chaotic, shifting, completely unformed substrate. It has no definition. It's just stuff.
So if the glop is already sitting there, then creation isn't about making the stuff.
No.
It's about organizing it.
You've hit the nail on the head. Plato's God, and we will get to exactly who that is in a minute, isn't a creator in the Genesis sense.
He's a shaper.
An organizer.
Yeah.
Imagine walking into a room filled with just chaotic noise, static screaming at you.
That's the glop.
Yes. Creation, for Plato, is the act of tuning that static into a symphony.
But the static was there first.
Always. And because the static, the matter, wasn't created by God, it has its own inherent properties.
It has its own resistance.
Exactly. Which is going to become extremely important when we ask why the universe has flaws.
Okay, hold that thought on the flaws. I want to look up for a second, back to the realm of being.
Sure.
We've got the glop at the bottom. We've got the forms at the top. But Dr. Holmes mentions that even the forms have a hierarchy. It's not just an equal democracy of ideas up there.
That's right. If you have a form of truth and a form of beauty and a form of justice, Plato naturally asks, what do they all have in common?
What makes them perfect?
Yes. What is the unifying factor?
They're all good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There has to be an ultimate principle that unifies everything in the realm of being. Plato calls this the form of the good, or sometimes just the good.
This is the part of the lecture where Holmes brings up the sun analogy from the Republic.
Yes.
I remember reading this back in college and really struggling to wrap my head around it, but Holmes breaks it down so clearly.
It's arguably one of the most famous analogies in all of philosophy. Plato asks us to think about what the sun actually does for the physical world.
Right.
It performs two very distinct functions. First, what does it do for your eyes?
Well, it lets me see. If there's no light, I can't perceive the tree in front of me. The tree is there, but it's invisible.
Right. The sun provides the medium, the light, that makes sight possible.
Okay.
In the realm of the mind, the good acts exactly like the sun. It provides the light of truth that allows our intellect to see or understand the forms.
So you can't truly understand justice without first understanding goodness.
Exactly. But the sun does something else, too. It doesn't just light up the tree.
It grows the tree.
Yes. This is the ontological point, the point about actual existence.
Yeah.
The sun provides the energy, the warmth, the literal season for the tree to exist and grow.
Without the sun, there is no tree, period.
Right.
So applying that to the philosophy side, the good isn't just a mental spotlight. It's the power source.
It is the source of the being of the forms. The forms only exist because they participate in the good. It's the ultimate reality. It's the anchor.
Everything else is just drifting, but the good is the solid ground.
Precisely. And Holmes mentions that this structure sounds suspiciously like monotheism.
It really does.
In another dialogue called the Parmenides, this ultimate principle is referred to as the One.
And you can see why early Jewish and Christian theologians read this and got so excited.
Oh, absolutely. They saw the One and thought, hey, that sounds exactly like our God. The Lord is one.
But here's the twist. And Holmes is very careful to point this out in the lecture. Plato's God figure, the character who actually builds the physical universe, isn't necessarily the One.
No, he's a different character entirely.
He's a separate entity.
Yes. We have to introduce the Demiurge.
Demiurge. I have to say, it sounds like a Dungeons & Dragons monster. Roll for initiative against the Demiurge.
It does sound imposing in English, but the Greek word demiurgos just means workman or craftsman.
A workman.
Yeah. In ancient Greece, these were the everyday people who made things for the public. The potters, the shipbuilders.
That's a huge contrast.
It is. Holmes points out a fascinating nuance here. The Demiurge is an artificer. He is not a king.
So he's the guy with the tool belt.
Well, Plato was an aristocrat, so he does create a bit of distance from common labor. He portrays the Demiurge more like a master architect.
Okay, that makes sense.
He's the planner. He looks up at the forms, which are his blueprints, and he looks down at the primal glop, which is his mess.
And because he is inherently good, he wants to make the mess look like the blueprints.
He wants to organize the chaos.
But, and this connects right back to what we said earlier, he didn't make the glop.
He did not.
He's just working with it.
And that is his crucial limitation.
Right.
If you are a sculptor working with pure, high-quality clay, you can make a beautiful, flawless statue.
But if you're working with, say, rotten wood or dry sand.
Exactly. There's a limit to what you can do. The material fights you.
This changes the whole power dynamic of how we view the creator.
Completely.
Because the Judeo-Christian God is usually seen as omnipotent, all-powerful. If he wants a rock to float, it floats.
But Plato's Demiurge is constrained.
Constrained by the material.
He is constrained by necessity. That's the term Plato uses for the erratic, stubborn nature of the material world.
A necessity.
Yes. But he does have help. And this is where Plato's cosmology gets really wild.
I love this part.
The Demiurge doesn't go down and physically mold the clay himself.
He hires a contractor.
In a way, yes.
Yeah.
He instills reason directly into the universe.
Meaning what, exactly?
Plato says the universe is not a dead machine. It's not a clockwork mechanism like Isaac Newton would later describe.
It's alive.
It is a living animal. It is besouled.
The world soul.
Yes, the psyche.
Think about the difference between a car and a horse. A car is a machine, right? It only moves if you force it to move.
Right.
But a horse has its own internal motion, its own life.
Plato thinks the universe is exactly like the horse. The Demiurge hands the blueprints to the world soul.
And the world soul is the active force.
Yes. It moves the stars. It grows the plants. It actively tries to organize the matter on a continuous basis.
It's a completely biological view of the cosmos. Everything is alive.
It's a very Greek perspective. Nature was full of divinities for them. But for Plato, this world soul acts as the bridge.
The bridge between the perfect forms and the messy glop.
Exactly. It stands right in the middle, trying to constantly drag the matter up toward perfection.
Okay, so let's recap the cast of characters here, because we have a few now.
Sure.
We have the good, which is the ultimate blueprint or standard.
Right.
We have the Demiurge, who is our master architect.
Yes.
We have the world soul, acting as the contractor on the ground.
Correct.
And we have the glop, the very difficult building material.
And this specific setup leads us directly to the problem of evil.
The garden hose.
The garden hose.
This is the part of Dr. Holmes' lecture that really stuck with me, because usually when you and I or anyone asks, why is there evil?
We usually mean moral evil or suffering.
Right. We mean, why did God let that earthquake happen? Or why is there disease?
And in a creation ex nihilo framework, where God made everything from scratch, that is a profoundly hard question to answer.
Because if he made everything from nothing, he made the potential for evil too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Plato has an out.
He actually has two outs, as Holmes describes them.
Yes, two distinct explanations. The first one basically boils down to don't blame the carpenter for the knot in the wood.
Right, this goes right back to the recalcitrant matter, the glop.
The glop resists the forms. It has this quality of blind necessity. It simply doesn't want to be organized.
It wants to be chaotic.
Yes. So natural evil things like disease, earthquakes, physical decay isn't born out of malice.
It's just the material world failing to hold its shape.
Exactly.
It's like building a sandcastle.
Right.
Eventually the sand just dries out and collapses. It's not that the sand is evil. It's just it's sand.
That is a perfect way to look at it. But the second explanation Plato offers is far more dynamic.
This comes from a dialogue called The Statesman.
Yes. And this is where Holmes introduces the analogy of the coiled spring. Or the garden hose.
Walk us through this, because it suggests that God isn't always steering the ship, which is a wild concept.
It suggests a massive cosmic cycle. Holmes describes an era where God the Demiurge is actively guiding the universe.
He's rotating it.
He's imparting order. Think of it like winding up a vintage clockwork toy.
Or twisting a garden hose really tight so it coils up perfectly.
Yes. So order is being applied from the outside. Force is being used to keep things together.
But then God lets go.
He releases the controls.
Why? Does he just get tired? Is he taking a nap?
Plato suggests it's just the inherent nature of the cosmic cycle. The physical universe is finite. It simply can't handle eternal perfection.
So God has to step back.
He steps back.
Yeah.
And what happens to a tightly coiled hose when you let go of the end?
It violently uncoils. It twists everywhere. It just becomes a tangled mess.
The universe begins to rotate in the exact opposite direction.
It starts to unwind.
It moves from order back toward chaos. Holmes calls this the forgetfulness of God.
The forgetfulness of God.
Yes. The universe literally forgets the perfect pattern it was supposed to follow.
That is genuinely terrifying. It's not just that individual things break down. It's that the universe itself has a natural tendency to degrade.
Entropy.
Entropy isn't a bug. It's the main feature of a world left alone.
And as it unwinds, things get progressively worse. Disorder increases. We approach what Plato calls the abyss of unlikeness.
Total dissolution back into the glop.
Total chaos.
But we're still here, so presumably we haven't hit the abyss yet.
Well, in Plato's story, just before total collapse, God takes the helm again.
He grabs the controls.
He reverses the spin and restores order. He actively saves the cosmos from total destruction.
It's literally a cosmic rescue mission.
It is. But think about what this implies about the nature of evil.
Right, because it implies that evil is just what happens when the universe is left to its own devices.
Yes, evil is the unwinding. It's the drift toward non-being.
So evil isn't a substance.
No. And this distinction is vital for understanding Plato. Evil isn't a thing like a rock or a bird. It has no independent existence.
It's a privation.
It's a lack of order. Think of a hole in a shirt. The hole isn't a thing, it's a lack of shirt.
Evil is a lack of good.
Exactly.
And this connects the natural evil, like the earthquake, with moral evil, human behavior.
Yes, because humans are part of this physical universe.
We have souls.
We do. And this is the ultimate payoff of the lecture. This is why Holmes says Plato's cosmology isn't just about stars and planets. It's a setup for his ethics.
Oh, interesting.
You as a human being listening to this are a microcosm of the universe.
You have a soul, which is like the world's soul, and a body, which is the glop.
You are a miniature battlefield.
The same cosmic war is going on inside of me.
Exactly. Your reason knows the forms. It knows you should be patient, kind, just.
That's the winding up part.
But your physical nature, your passions, your instincts, your matter wants to unwind.
It wants to do whatever is easiest in the moment.
It wants chaos.
So if I just let go, if I just do what comes naturally, I'm not going to magically be a good person.
Yeah.
I'm going to unwind.
Precisely. And think about how countercultural that is today. In the modern world, we constantly hear things like, just be yourself.
Follow your instincts. Go with the flow.
Plato would be completely horrified by that advice.
Really?
Yes. For him, the flow is the current dragging you toward the abyss of unlikeness.
The flow is the drain.
The flow is the drain. To be good, to be truly virtuous, is to actively swim upstream.
It is a forceful attempt to impose order on your own internal chaos.
You literally have to act like the demiurge of your own life.
That completely reframes the whole idea of virtue for me. It's not just following a list of rules so you don't get in trouble.
No, it's an act of creation.
Or rather, an act of maintenance. You're holding the structure of your life together against the natural rot.
Holmes quotes the Theaetetus in the lecture, where Plato says we must make all speed to take flight from this world to the other.
That sounds a bit escapist, doesn't it? Like we should just sit around meditating and ignore physical reality.
It does sound like that, but Holmes is quick to clarify that's not what Plato meant.
Yeah.
The flight isn't physically leaving. It's becoming like the divine.
It's not leaving the world. It's acting like God inside the world.
Exactly. God brings order to the cosmos.
Yeah.
You bring order to your life.
You fight the entropy.
You fight the entropy. And this applies to politics and society too, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The Republic is basically entirely about this concept applied to a city.
It is. A society can unwind just like the garden hose.
It can slide from order to chaos.
Right. From a republic to a democracy, which, and we're just reporting his views here, not endorsing them. Plato actually didn't like much.
He saw it as unstable.
Yes. A slide into tyranny. That slide is the natural degradation of political order if you just let go.
So keeping a society just requires constant active effort. It never runs on autopilot. I think that's honestly the most haunting part of this whole lecture. The idea that stability is an anomaly. Chaos is the default.
It's a heavy thought, but I'd also think it's incredibly empowering.
How so?
It means that every single act of goodness, every act of self-control, every time you choose to be rational instead of reactive.
You are participating in the cosmic act of creation.
Yes, you're siding with the artificer against the glop.
You're winding the hose back up.
You're actively winding it back up.
Man. So we've traveled from the primal glop up to the eternal forms, met a hardworking architect, and watched the entire universe spin backward.
It is quite a long journey for a single lecture.
It really is. So if we try to boil this all down for the listener, someone who's just trying to navigate their own chaotic week right now,
sure.
What is the one core thing they should take away from Plato's theology?
I would say it's his definition of the good.
Okay.
Goodness isn't just a nice warm feeling. Mm-hmm. It is the literal source of reality.
Because of the sun analogy.
Right. To be good is to be more real.
And to be evil.
To be evil or chaotic is to fade into nothingness, non-being.
We tend to think evil is the strong, aggressive force, and good is weak or passive.
But Plato says the exact opposite. Mm. Good is the only thing that actually has power.
Because evil is just the battery running out.
That is a brilliant way to phrase it. Yes.
That is such a powerful shift in perspective. It makes being a good person feel less like a chore and more like survival.
It is the ultimate survival.
I want to leave everyone listening with a final thought to chew on today.
Let's hear it.
We talked a lot about the unwinding, the idea that nature, when left completely alone, breaks down.
Right. Entropy.
But we live in a time right now that is utterly obsessed with the concept of the natural.
We do. Natural food, natural behavior, natural order.
We constantly equate natural with good.
Which is a very romantic idea from the Romantic era.
Right. But Plato is telling us here that nature, in the sense of the physical material world, is actually the antagonist.
It is the glop.
It's the thing actively trying to pull the beautiful sculpture back into the mud. Yeah. So, if you think about that, here is the question for you to ponder. Is civilization, is human morality, is love itself inherently artificial?
Artificial in the sense of being artifice, creating by art and willpower.
Yes.
I think Plato would say yes.
And if that's true, maybe we should stop trying to constantly get back to nature.
And start trying to build something better than nature.
That's the challenge. The artificial, the structured, might actually be the most divine thing we have.
That is a very provocative thought to end on.
Thanks for taking this deep dive with us today. Go impose some order on your chaos.
Until next time.